Right, let's get started. So welcome to our latest webinar. For those of you who are new to our series, I am Adrienne Hardy, a partner with MPM Legal, and we specialise in employment law and business immigration, and we support clients from all over the world who all share a common interest in employing people in the UK. Now, you may have noticed that it is just me today. I am flying solo, and I'm really sad about that, but Peter's away today, so I'm really sorry that you will only get to listen to me, so I hope my voice is not going to be too dull and boring for you for the next half an hour. Feel free, as usual, to send in your queries using the Q&A function. I'll do my best to answer them. I do have to say that this isn't strictly legal advice, guidance only. And of course, if you do need specifics and any assistance, then please do get in touch. We'd be pleased to help. This is being recorded and it will go up on our website as usual. And you can also access it on our Spotify, Amazon Music and Apple Music channels. And for those not listening live, I do just want to say that today's date is the 29th of May, 2025. Okay, right, we've got all that out the way. I am going to talk to you today about an unfair dismissal case, and I'm going to use it as a basis to talk to you about a part of tribunal litigation that sometimes gets overlooked when you're in the thick of preparing a claim. Everybody seems to focus on fighting the liability issues. So, you know, whether or not you're going to win or whether or not you're going to lose. And all the witness statements and all the documents that you're preparing generally go towards fighting the liability. But what I'm talking about today in particular is going to be just unfair dismissal cases. I'm not going to touch necessarily on discrimination cases. So in terms of liability, of course, just as a quick reminder, we've got five potentially fair reasons for dismissal, and each of those requires a certain process. Cases can be substantively unfair. In other words, the tribunal decides that the dismissal itself was unfair, the reasoning behind it, or dismissals can be procedurally unfair, or they can be both. Hopefully not both. I think we've covered this in previous sessions. So if you do want a refresher on this, please do take a look back at our previous episodes if you're interested. But just by way of examples, talking about redundancy, you know, a procedural piece might be that you didn't quite get your pooling for redundancy quite right, or perhaps you forgot to talk in detail about an individual score. I mean, there's loads of bits in redundancy where there can be flaws in the process. It is actually a really complex matter. And I know a lot of people think about redundancy as perhaps being an easier route to go down, but the procedure can be fraught with difficulty, and there's lots of nuances. So there's plenty of scope there for procedural unfairness. Misconduct dismissals, maybe you didn't offer a right of appeal or something went wrong in the process. Perhaps you had the same person doing the investigation who then did the disciplinary. So there's all those types of nuances. So I want to take you through this particular case. And this is the sad OME, read about it in the paper. And as I think I've said before on some of our webinars, I then go, oh, that's an interesting case. Let's just see if the press have actually reported it accurately. And I go on to the Employment Tribunal decision website where you can pop in the name of the case and then you can read the actual judgment. And I know I really must get out more. But anyway, the case that was reported was a case called Remyard and JP Morgan. And the judgment was posted on the government site earlier this month. Bear with me, it's complicated. The case was about a trader who was summarily dismissed, i.e. without notice, for gross misconduct when his employer found that he was guilty of something called spoofing. Now, it's all to do with trading, and I have to confess that even reading the judgment, I wasn't totally clear on what that was. So let's just go with the idea that it was some type of unlawful trading, went against their compliance rules, all that type of stuff. So I'm not going to go into a massive amount of details, but if you do want to read it, then just jump onto the Employment Tribunal website and take a look. But I do want to pull out some key points because I think there's some learnings that can be taken out of this. So some of the key points in the case were the timing of the investigation was important. Now, they did a compliance audit and discovered this unlawful spoofing some 4 years after it actually happened. And immediately you might be thinking, oh, can they really take disciplinary action against somebody for something that they did 4 years ago? Very good question. And in fact, one of the claimant's points was that he couldn't possibly remember his intentions in relation to the trades that were that happened that long ago, which I think is probably quite fair. Second point, the claimant was not happy with the evidence that was provided to him before he was when he was sent the disciplinary invite. And as you know, fairness dictates that any evidence that's going to be relied upon in making the decision should be sent to the employee ahead of the hearing so that they've got time to prepare their case. And you can imagine in this case, if we're 4 years on, it is even more relevant that that would happen because the claimant would need time to process and look over the data from such a long time ago. But in this case, the claimant asked during the investigation and during the disciplinary process for some more data to be provided to him because it was his point that that data might support his argument that he actually hadn't done anything wrong. And what transpired as part of the case was that the disciplinary manager had been sent further information, which he had then reviewed. He had discounted it and said it wasn't really materially relevant, but he hadn't actually shared that data with the claimant. Now, at the hearing in front of the tribunal judge, and if we remember for unfair dismissal cases, it's a judge sitting alone, it's not a panel. The disciplinary manager was very persuasive, very credible in explaining his thought processes regarding his review of this additional information and that he had considered the request from the claimant and thought actually the material just wasn't relevant to the allegations. So that's the second point. Third point, the tribunal found that the disciplinary manager was a credible witness and that actually in reviewing the information himself, he discounted it because there was other evidence that was pointing towards the claimant's guilt. And I think there was also a slight flaw in the plan in terms of preparation from the claimant's perspective, because what the judge said is, if you really wanted this data and you are so convinced that this would prove your innocence, why didn't you apply to the tribunal for specific disclosure? So specific disclosure is, dear tribunal, I think the respondent has these specific documents that I want to see and I want you to order them to send them to me. And then the judge had basically said, if I'd had those before me, I would have been able to look at them. However, you didn't make that application. Those documents aren't before me. So I've no idea what they say. So that was quite interesting too. The fourth point, and this is material, is how long this whole investigation and disciplinary process took. Now, I've got plenty of clients going, oh, disciplinary manager's on holiday for a couple of weeks. Is that okay? And the answer is very often, yes, it will probably be fine, but we really do need to get onto it. Now, listen to the time frame in this one. It is crazy. So we've got the notes of the disciplinary hearing only being sent to the claimant with a disciplinary outcome letter. And the disciplinary outcome letter was sent 8 months after the disciplinary meeting. So it's quite an unbelievable time frame. And during this time, the claimant is suspended as well. I think he was suspended for the whole period of time, but certainly for a lengthy period. But in any event, he obviously was dismissed for gross misconduct because the disciplinary manager just didn't believe the claimant's explanation for the trading. Now, in terms of timing, it doesn't get much better. So the claimant appealed literally within days of being dismissed, which was in the December. The first appeal hearing took place almost 2 months later in February. Which, okay, that's quite a long period of time. But then there was a further appeal meeting, probably to deliver the outcome, and that didn't happen until July. So, I mean, already you're thinking, kind of on the back foot here in terms of timing. The notes of the appeal meeting, again, not sent to him until the appeal outcome letter, which was sent almost 7 months later than the appeal hearing in February in the September. So we had the second meeting in the July and the appeal outcome sent in the September, bearing in mind he was dismissed in December. So it's a significant period of time, shall we say. Now, there is a rule in unfair dismissal cases that can be quite helpful. And this is always something to bear in mind, that when you are looking at an appeal, it's always important to kind of look through all this procedural stuff and see, well, did we make any mistakes? Should we have sent this? Now, the claimant had said, you didn't send me this data. So the appeal manager could have said, okay, I can see that he's still complaining that he wasn't sent this data. Let's send it to him now, give him the chance to look at it. We can discuss it. And that is kind of putting right a potential disciplinary flaw. So the appeal process can be really useful to put that right, provided obviously it's reviewed and discussed properly. But the appeal manager still didn't send the requested data to the claimant. So he got all the way to the tribunal, where he could then run the argument that the evidence that was provided was short of what he wanted. So what did the tribunal say about all of this? Well, the depth of an investigation will depend on the allegations in each case. And as you know, the law requires that the employer must carry out such investigation as is reasonable in all the circumstances. And that will just vary wildly depending on what the allegations are that we're talking about. In this case, we're talking about detailed trades with documents that make, well, I don't understand, they're called blotters or something like that. I don't know if anybody's in trading that will understand that, but I certainly didn't. But a very data heavy case. And, you know, then you've got the time gap of the 4 years. And so, you know, the tribunal was expecting to see a detailed and thorough investigation. Interestingly, what the tribunal said as well, a good point to remember, is that the investigation shouldn't just focus on gathering evidence that would support the allegations, but also those that may end up favouring the employee. And it isn't okay to say that actually not having that evidence or submitting it would have made no difference to the outcome. That's not part of a fair process. So just bear that in mind, put a pin in that, because we'll come back to it later when I talk about remedy. So remembering investigation, it's gathering all relevant evidence, whether it supports the allegations or not. That's what a fair process should be. Thirdly, the tribunal reminded itself that it's not allowed to say what it would have done in the employer's position. And this is appealable grounds in a tribunal, because, right, the tribunal judge is human. They will go in their heads, they might go, well, I wouldn't have done that, or I wouldn't have reached that decision. They're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to substitute their own decision. That would be overstepping. Their job is simply to look at whether the employer acted reasonably. There's the phrase within the band of reasonable responses. So would a reasonable employer have taken these steps? Would a reasonable employer have taken any additional steps? That's what the tribunal has to look at. So then we're looking at whether or not there's a procedural failing. Okay, a delay in handling the disciplinary may of itself make it an unfair dismissal. So in this case, waiting that 4 year period could have made the dismissal unfair, but not necessarily. The tribunal did accept that the potentially fair reason for dismissal was misconduct. I think for some reason the respondents had also pleaded some other substantial reason route, but the judgment didn't really go into that. They just kind of said, no, we're going to ignore that because we're happy that it is misconduct. And the judge also found that on the basis of the evidence that was before him, he also believed that the claimant was guilty of the misconduct. Okay, so that's two sort of major points, that's major hurdles that the respondent got over. He also said that he thought that the disciplinary investigation was thorough. And I should expect it would be if it took that long. So far, so good, right? But here's the two points where it went a little bit wrong. The judge said that the decision not to give the claimant the data that he'd asked for was not reasonable. It should have been provided, even if ultimately it didn't change the dismissing manager's mind. That was one procedural flaw. And that was on the basis that if the claimant asked for it, and the claimant's job in the disciplinary is to put forward his defence, right? So if he doesn't have all the information, he's not armed with enough evidence to say, actually, this would support my explanation to say why I hadn't done anything wrong. So then we come on to the delay, and I've already said that the delay in raising the matter some 4 years later was actually not a problem in the judge's mind, accepted that because compliance had only just found out, they'd for other wider reasons going on with the respondent at the time, that's when they'd gone back and done their trawl, and they'd looked at these particular trades and thought, that's something's not right there. It was enough that they said, okay, it might be 4 years ago, we're okay to go ahead and discipline now. But it was the delay in providing the outcome So in other words, once they've made the decision to go ahead, it was then this massive delay in the investigation and the disciplinary, holding this guy on suspension until such time as they delivered the outcome. And you know, I have to say, rightly so, it was an awfully long time for somebody to have that hanging over them to wait to hear their fate. So those were the kind of the two points where the tribunal found that the dismissal was procedurally unfair. It wasn't substantively unfair. There was misconduct. The judge was confident that he believed that the claimant was guilty of misconduct, but it was the process that let them down. So, hurrah, thought the claimant, I've won my claim. Brilliant. I've been unfairly dismissed. And this is the whole point of the session. So thanks for bearing with me so far. Hopefully you're still with me. But this is where it's not all over just because liability is decided. The tribunal then has to move on to consider the remedy. So the claimants go, woohoo, brilliant. I've won. Now I'm going to get loads of money. Not so fast. Okay. So we're talking about compensation for unfair dismissal. And there are several points relating to remedy that are often kind of overlooked, as I've said, when people are so busy focusing on the liability point. So first of all, I'm going to talk about the Polkey argument, which I'm sure most of you will have heard of. But for those of you that haven't, this approach is named after a key case. And it basically is where a tribunal must go on to consider in an unfair dismissal case that whether there was a chance that the employment would have ended anyway, had there not been this procedural unfairness. And, you know, it's a case of, okay, so if there hadn't been procedural unfairness, what would have happened to the claimant? How would have his employment panned out? And there are two examples that I want to give you to think about. So remember when I said just now, put a pin in it, remember it. You know, a defective process can't get away with that in an unfair dismissal. So you won't win a claim with a defective process because there will be a finding of unfair dismissal based on procedural flaws. So procedurally unfair. But it does become important if you have the evidence to show that the dismissal would have happened anyway, then that's a really critical piece of defending any unfair dismissal case. So, for example, in this case, had the data been provided to the claimant as he had requested, he would have had the opportunity to discuss it at the disciplinary hearing. The disciplinary manager, who had already seen it and went, well, it's irrelevant and it doesn't help him, doesn't help his explanation. All of that would have come out at the tribunal, and the disciplinary manager would have been able to explain that and that he'd had the discussions with the claimant, and that would have made the dismissal fair. Okay, so it would have made no difference to the outcome. The second example is something slightly different. So say, for example, there's, you know, you've dismissed an employee, and then say 3 months later, you've decided that you're making redundancies, and the claimant would have been impacted and would have left through redundancy like 3 months after he was dismissed for something else. This is hugely important because the employer can bring in evidence to show this, and that will limit the claimant's compensation, because compensation in the employment tribunal is largely about loss of earnings that flow from the dismissal. So it's about sort of trying to sort of map out what the time would look like after the dismissal in relation to the claimant's employment. So, you know, would he have remained in employment had the procedure been fair? If so, then there's all those loss of earnings. But if we can show, hang on a minute, something would have happened in the business which meant that his employment would have ended anyway, unrelated to whatever the reason for dismissal was, then that's going to be your limiter. And the tribunal will say, okay, I've seen the evidence that's been put before me. I can see that there's redundancy. I can see that the respondent has put together the reasoning why the claimant would have been impacted and set out the chances that he would have been made redundant on a certain date. And therefore, what I'm going to do is I'm only going to award him compensation up to the date that he would have been made redundant. So in the example that I've given, that would have been 3 months' pay, and 3 months' pay and benefits is always worth remembering, because it's the whole package that gets looked at when it comes to compensation. So you can see how thinking ahead in terms of, well, let's not just focus on liability. Let's think about, if we do lose, what's the type of money that we're going to be looking at, and just think around what evidence we can put in to deal with that particular point. The second point is something that people mainly refer to as contributory fault. And this is where the employee contributes to their own downfall. So if you can show, like in this case, that the employee caused or they contributed to what happened, then compensation can be reduced. And this is done on an equitable basis, and it's looking at whether or not there was blameworthy conduct. And in this case, there was, because he did the unlawful trades, and therefore, had he not done that, he wouldn't have been in this position. And then the tribunal can decide to reduce not just the compensatory award, so that's the loss of earnings piece that I was just talking about, but it can also reduce the basic award, which is the other part of compensation that's payable in an employment tribunal. That's the bit that's equivalent to the statutory redundancy payment based on length of service, age, weekly pay, etc., that's awarded in unfair dismissal claims. Finally, mitigation. And for those of you that have worked with us on tribunal cases, you'll know that we always ask you to deal with mitigation. So remember that tribunals award compensation for losses suffered, and the bulk of awards is loss of earnings. So if, for example, a claimant gets a new job within 4 months of dismissal at a similar rate of pay and benefits, you know, remembering the benefits also count, then the tribunal will say, well, you've mitigated your losses. You've found a new job, you're earning the same as you did before, and the only gap where you weren't earning is 4 months, so that's what you're going to be awarded. And this is often a point that comes up when we're advising on settlement agreements, when we sit on the other side of the fence, and we might be saying to employees, what does the job market look like for you? Do you think you'll be able to get a job relatively easily? Because if so, that's going to then drive the thought process as whether the offer under a settlement agreement is reasonable or not. But if they say, oh, it's going to take me 9 months to find a job because the market is awful at the moment, then obviously then that's going to drive a different decision. And it's the same in an employment tribunal. So we might say to you at the point when you're thinking about dismissing somebody, what's the job market like? Will this person be able to get another job? Perhaps less so when we're talking about gross misconduct in trading, that type of stuff, because that potentially is problematic. But, you know, in other types of dismissals, it is always worth thinking about what alternative roles there are out there. And that's where your things like your outplacement services can help, because you are helping the employee on the journey to try and find alternative work, which ultimately is going to work in your favour if they can and they find another job. So, What does a tribunal do when it looks at the employee's duty to mitigate? Well, having sort of made a big thing about how important it is to do the mitigation piece, it's not actually a very high bar. The tribunal doesn't want to penalise a claimant too much by holding them to too high a standard on their duty to mitigate, because they recognise that there's already been wrongdoing, they've already been dismissed. But they will say, so what have you done to find another job? Because employees can't just sit back and wait for the compensation to roll in. That's not how it works. But the burden of proof is on you as the employer to raise this as a valid argument. And it is super important, because if you don't raise it, the tribunal is under absolutely no obligation to make a finding that the claimant failed to mitigate. So if you pop up and you say, claimants failed to mitigate, oh, and by the way, here's evidence of all the jobs that the claimant could have applied for, and we want to cross-examine him on whether he did, why he didn't, etc., and so on, then you're putting yourself in the best possible position to raise this and invite the judge then to make a finding that the claimant perhaps didn't do enough to find another job. But as I said, they don't look at it too strictly, but I think it's still really important that you do it. And here's the thing, do it as soon as the dismissal has happened if you think you're heading down the route of litigation, because obviously it's that critical time when the employee has been dismissed, they're out of work. That's the point where we want to be saying, right, here's all these jobs that are available for you to apply for. Where's your job applications? Where's your interviews? Where's your job offers, if they get any? And that's how you start to run that argument. And it's much easier to start that search process from day one, rather than wait until sort of like 8, 9, 10 months down the line, where we're preparing disclosure, we're preparing the trial bundles, and we want to raise this argument where we go, well, have we got any mitigation evidence? These are really difficult, obviously, to go back in time and try and recreate job ads that are probably long filled. So build up the body of evidence that you can from the start, because otherwise you lose that sort of valuable months of data that you can use. I mean, what you can also do is start sending them to the claimant going, hey, we want to help you find another job. Here's a bunch of stuff that we found for you. It's not normally well received, I will be honest, but ultimately it's a step that you can take because your clear message to the claimant is we're going to be raising the mitigation argument. And also then you can say to the judge, look, we tried to help him out. We tried to send these job ads and that was the reason for sending it to them. One of the things that often comes up is what if the employee decides not to get another job? What if the employee decides to go self-employed? Now, this can also be challenged in terms of what was their thought process? Did they try to find another job and when it was difficult, they decided to maybe go back to study or they decided to set up their own business? All of that is going to be material evidence. I can't say to you, well, you know, they tried to set up their own business and therefore the duty to mitigate kind of falls away. But equally, I can't say, aha, they didn't even bother trying to find a job. They'd set up their own business and this is what they did. It's all very fact sensitive, but it's all stuff that's up for grabs at an employment tribunal. And that's what they will look at if you raise it. So, well, what can we take from all of this? And apologies if I've just absolutely deluged you with loads of information. I suppose the output of this is, yes, liability is important. Of course it is. But don't overlook the remedy part of the preparation. You might lose on liability, but you should also prepare to deal with remedy. And that's all about the value of the case. Think about the evidence you can put forward to show that the decision would have been the same. Had you done the right thing? Had you corrected the flaws? And the evidence before the tribunal needs to be strong on this. And it can lead to a substantial reduction in compensation. In the case that I'm talking about, the evidence that was before the tribunal meant that the judge was comfortable that the chances of the failure to provide the right data would have led to the same outcome and made a reduction of 95%. On compensation. So, you know, it ends up with the claimant having very much a Pyrrhic victory. Yes, I've won. Oops, I don't get anything for it. So it's hugely important. Just one other thing I was just going to mention about this case. When it came to the delay in the outcome, bearing in mind the employee was paid, got all his contractual benefits throughout that period while he was suspended, there was a really interesting bit in the judgment. Sad again, sorry, where the judge basically said, well, of course, if a decision had been made earlier, he'd have been out of work earlier. So in a way, he kind of factored into his decision that during this period of suspension, he did continue to be paid throughout. And I thought that was quite interesting. So it would have been quite interesting, I think, to be in that hearing, to listen to the way that the witnesses came across. Finally, would employment have ended a short while later? Did you restructure? Did you make redundancies? If so, make sure that evidence is in the bundle of documents to show how the claimant would have been impacted. Well, I've come to the end of my talk, and normally I'd be talking to Peter about other things, and I'm all on my own. And I just really appreciate you listening today. We're going to finish a little bit early. I hope it's been useful. I would say that I think tribunal litigation is on the increase, and obviously with the changes in the Employment Rights Bill coming up, I think we're going to see an awful lot of them. So the more you can think about some of these things in preparation, unless of course you're going down the route of settlement agreements all the time, I think that would be a very good idea. Some questions have come in. Okay, so let me just ask very quickly. Oh, yes. Was he paid while suspended? Yes. Obviously, when you suspend somebody pending a disciplinary outcome, you must make sure that you pay them, and it would be a breach of contract if you didn't. Because if you remember, suspension pending disciplinary is not a sanction in itself. It's just to make sure that it's because they're going to interfere with the investigation, or you don't want them to be working on sensitive stuff. So you absolutely must pay them, and he was paid in this one. Second question, is the judge's decision re-getting paid during suspension a decision held in other cases? If you mean that, you know, he was suspended for that long time and the judge made a comment that he had the benefit of being paid during that, No, it's not something I've seen in other cases. That's why I thought it was quite unusual to read that. So I wouldn't rely on that necessarily as a legal argument if your process ends up taking a lot longer than you think. My preference is to crack on with the process, obviously, but it would be interesting to see whether or not we could run that argument in other cases where any process might have taken longer than we thought, provided the employees got the benefit of being paid. So there we go. All right. Okay. Well, that's it for today, everybody. Sorry to be talking about tribunal claims. I hope that you've all got some lovely positive stuff on your desks for the rest of the day, and have a good one and see you next time. Thank you.